Hi, this is Arnie Artisan, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Artisan. Fridays, Texas, Scott Braddock, the editor of the Quam Report, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And God, I tell you, Scott, this is the last Friday before the Iowa caucus. So next Friday.
It's all happening so quickly, the
right.
Iowa caucus. Then I'll be there to see you in New Hampshire.
I tell you.
Week after that, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's real fast.
Well, and I think Iowa is going to have a greater impact on how people sort of process for New Hampshire than historically possible.
But why do you think it's going to impact New Hampshire more this time?
Well, you know, in an interesting way, so I was listening to someone say that Joe Biden is doing something fascinating in Iowa. He's beginning to heavily court the Amy Klobuchar supporters and basically saying, so if you like Amy, and I understand the Midwest, I like her too, wink, wink, nod, nod. Therefore, I think you should support me, almost as a way without saying that he might consider Amy as a VP. He doesn't say it at all. He doesn't even imply it, but he kind of does.
Yeah.
You know,
he's kind of like
Donald Trump. But I have to have a favor, though. You know,
well, it's like dating, right? It's like
dating
or not.
Yeah, exactly.
Or not. You try to figure it out. You pull the petals off the flower.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk, since I mentioned the caucus and how impressive the caucus will be and why it may impact the New Hampshire primary. This story I actually posted on Facebook because I saw it as well. Bernie Sanders surges in Texas 3 weeks before early voting poll shows. So Bernie is obviously he's courting folks everywhere. We know that there's a changing demographic in Texas. We know that what he does incredibly well with are young African-American voters, young Hispanic voters. We know that really sort of describes what the future of Texas will look like. So talk to me a little bit about what Bernie is doing and why we need to pay attention, especially because early voting is possible in Texas.
Well, this is from the Texas Lyceum. It's a poll that's been around for a long time in Texas. So there's a paucity of public polling in Texas. So anytime we get any, we eat it up, Arnie. But we're not like the early states where you have all that public polling.
Right.
You know, in New Hampshire and Iowa and Nevada and South Carolina.
Yeah, every hour.
Every hour something comes out. Now in Texas, you know, I mean, I went out of my way in this House race that we'll talk about here in just a little bit because it was a focus of some national attention. I went out of my way to almost have to steal a poll in that race, so I would know what I was talking about, Arnie. But in this, I'll tell you what that was about.
Okay.
But this deal here says, I'm going to read the numbers to you, Biden's still leading the pack of the Democratic presidential contenders at 28% in Texas in this Lyceum poll. But his lead over Sanders is at 26%.
So a statistical tie.
So it's within the 2.8%.
Right, exactly.
Margin
statistical
of error,
tile.
Right.
Exactly.
So they're basically tied here in Texas, according to this. Elizabeth Warren, she is at 13%, and then on down from there. I was at a Democratic event earlier this week, where you know you've got some activists arguing Biden is the only one who can win Texas, over Trump, and then Bernie can win Texas over Trump. I'm still of the opinion neither of these folks can win Texas. No Democrat can win Texas over Trump. That's where I am right now. Mm-hmm. Who knows? We don't make predictions around here. Bernie has that, younger vote.
He does. Nailed.
Appeal. And I will say this, Arnie. It's kind of interesting. You mentioned his African-American support. You mentioned his Hispanic support. In Texas, and some of this is anecdotal, but some of it's based on the data from 2018, I mentioned a lack of public polling here, but because there was so much attention of the 2018 U.S. Senate race here, we actually had exit polling in Texas. We almost never get that, and we found out a few things from that. They're pretty interesting. One, there's always this talk about people who are moving to Texas are going to turn Texas blue. You know, baby, you had Governor Abbott last week say, if you come in from California, New Jersey, New York, whatever, don't bring those politics with you. Basically, he said, don't screw it up when you get here. But in that exit polling from the Senate race, we learned that native-born Texans were trending toward the Democrat, Representative O'Rourke, and those who had just moved here in the last decade or so were trending toward the Republican, toward Senator Cruz. That's one thing. We also saw a big surge in Hispanic voting. And, Arnie, I have my whole career, we've always heard about the sleeping giant of the Latino vote. At some point, they'll wake up, start voting. That will change the elections in the state, and that just never would happen. But in 2018, we did see a very different result. just 4 years prior. Remember, Democrats were losing to Republicans at the statewide level by 21 points. In fact, by 26 points in the U.S. Senate race when John Cornyn was on the ballot.
Oh, my God.
In 2018, what happened? Well, statewide Democrats were coming within 2 and 3 points of beating the Republicans in those races. And all across the state, as you have mentioned many times, that had incredible down-ballot effect where you had 12 new Democrats in the Texas House, 2 new Democrats in the Texas Senate, and 2 congressional districts flip from Republican to Democratic in both Dallas and in Harris County, where Houston is. And so looking at that, you have to wonder, what's driving it? What is the thing? Well, we had a fundamental policy shift here, Arnie, for a long time, but probably since about 2006. It has been, you know, standard Republican talking points around here to talk about border security, to stem the flow of illegal immigration and all of that. I remember Governor Perry in 2006. I always say he found the Trump base in 2006 because his main push was border security. And by the way, that was with President Bush in office. And I say he found the Trump base because his whole campaign, most of it was about border security. And in his ads, Governor Perry at the time would say, if Washington won't secure this border, Texas will. And he stood there on the river, on the Rio Grande, with his Carhartt jacket, you know, looking like a supermodel and all of that. He was in a four-way race for governor.
Yeah.
Plurality wins. And he won the race, Arnie, by, check this out, he won the race by 38%, with 38%.
Okay.
38% is basically the Trump base, right? It's always right at 35 to 40%, something like that.
The sweet spot.
That was the support that that Perry, you know, harnessed to win that race against three challengers that November. But look, the but he still didn't go in a policy direction on that. You still had Governor Perry arguing for the Texas Dream Act, which allows undocumented students to go to college here.
Okay.
You had a lot of anger on the Republican side because they were starting to hear this rhetoric, and the rhetoric was coming from politicians playing to the people who are already mad about this stuff. But it was being fomented, Arnie, you know, all this anti-immigrant sentiment. But there were proposals to ban sanctuary cities in Texas, to you know, deny government benefits to you know, undocumented people in Texas, to try to kick them out of public schools and all that sort of stuff. And none of that happened until 2017. And I was talking to some business groups this this past weekend, and thought about it this way, Arnie. In 2017, it was a dumpster fire of a legislative session. The governor's priorities were things that included rewriting the United States Constitution through a convention of states.
That's right.
He also pushed, as you may remember, a ban on sanctuary cities, similar to what had been passed in Arizona, SB 1070, which included the "show me your papers" language. Right. Show me your papers language that never you know, saw the light of day when Governor Perry was in office. And in 2017, when I asked people, like, what do you remember from that legislative session? In one word, what do you remember from 2017 in Texas? People will say bathrooms.
Thank you.
And you know what
I started to observe,
Arnie?
Yep, yep.
Well, you know what I started to notice? The people who say bathrooms are white people.
Yes.
The people who remember that are the ones who are thinking, oh, white people were being told where they could and could not go to the bathroom. You know what Hispanics remember from 2017? That the governor was pushing a policy that would, as one put it to me, that would, quote, kick my grandma out of Houston, unquote. And so this is the thing that is waking
up the sleeping
giant.
Oh, my God, this is brilliant. This is brilliant. This is brilliant.
This is what's awakened the sleeping giant. When I talk anecdotally to staffers, to those who are working for legislators or people who are working on Democratic campaigns in this cycle, the young Latinos will tell me that bill is the reason they're involved in politics. That is what got their attention. That is why they have anything to do with this. And that's why they're supporting Democrats for the Texas House of Representatives, which, as you know, as we've been talking about, is definitely in play this fall. I don't think the presidency and the presidential race is in play, that Texas is in play for that. But in the legislative races, We're going to be watching it real close.
You need to write the national op-ed about that. What you just said about what Latinos noticed of what happened in 2017 versus what white people noticed in 2017 talks volumes about our experience, talks volumes about consequence, talks volumes about how we process. And the national media is made up of predominantly people that look like me and you, white people. So we're going to talk a lot about a damn bathroom bill. And yet that bathroom bill, first of all,
it was a joke. Well, yeah.
It was terrible, but it's
neither
it was
one's good.
It was just it was, were, exactly exactly it was just done to hurt. It accomplished nothing. It was just done to hurt. But understand when I say bathroom, I have this sort of relationship. When you described what was happening, you know, kick my grandmother out of Houston, you know, they're not kicking my grandmother out, but they are kicking their grandmother out. And we need to understand the consequences were far more real for them than they ever were for me. But what did we pay attention to? We paid attention to bathroom bills. Oh, my God, this is so important. But it does really describe why they are the sleeping giant, because they suddenly realize that actions have consequences, and one of the actions they need to take is to vote.
The percentage of people in the United States who identify as transgender is 0.6.
Thank you. Okay? Thank you.
Who are Hispanic, this is what they call a majority-minority state at this point. And so to be pissing all those people off, maybe not the best idea ever. Politics, as you know, Arnie, and winning elections is about addition, not subtraction.
Thank you. Thank you. And that's one of the reasons, why Bernie is attractive to people is that they see Bernie as the addition candidate and they see the Biden candidacy as the running in place candidate. There's a fabulous, you'll have to go to my Facebook page, my personal Facebook page. There was a wonderful article and it was describing the Biden-Bernie fight. And this is interesting for Texas as well. As you pointed out, the Lyceum poll, what is it, Biden 2 points ahead of Bernie, which means a statistical dead heat. It was fear versus fearlessness. And it was basically saying that Biden is running to say, I will help you. You have nothing to fear. Okay, that idea. And Bernie is talking about the fact that you need to find your courage. You need to be fearless if we're going to confront all the challenges going forward. So one is sort of, you know, sort of patting you on the head and rubbing your forehead. And the other one is grabbing your arm and saying, we got to do this together. I can't promise everything, but I know that if we just run in place, we fail.
Yeah. It's
unbelievable.
I think it's playing it safe. Folks are done with that in politics. They want to see. I'll quote Ted Cruz, who often quotes Ronald Reagan, that the voters don't want pale pastels.
Exactly. Let me ask you
bold
a sidebar.
Colors. Oh,
right. Exactly. Bold. Well, I'm the queen of bold colors. Anyway, right. let me ask you a sidebar question that was not on the list of stuff you wanted to talk about.
But
I've been thinking a lot about this. So we know that Julian Castro endorsed Elizabeth Warren. At this point, I don't believe Beto has endorsed anyone. So let me tell you what I've been thinking about, and you're going to think I'm totally nuts.
He was at a Bloomberg event.
Yes.
By the way, in El Paso.
Oh my God! Oh my God! I'm channeling you. That was my point. My point was I bet that Bloomberg is heavily courting Beto, and Beto is thinking about it. I was just going to talk about this, that Beto had talked about guns, that he talked about what he wanted to do with guns because of what happened in El Paso. Bloomberg is notorious nationwide. The mayors around the country love him because of what he's willing to do about the whole gun issue. The mayor of Washington, D.C. just endorsed Mayor Bloomberg. You're seeing mayors around the country endorsing him. I am thinking about the campaign that Beto ran. I'm thinking about the kind of moderate that Beto is. He's very comfortable with people who make a lot of money. But at the same time, there's a passion about him that is very, very positive. And I think in a lot of ways, Bloomberg needs Beto. And I think Beto knows it.
At that event in El Paso, a state representative who is running for state Senate for a seat that's being vacated, Arnie, a guy by the name of Cesar Blanco, had previously endorsed O'Rourke. And Castro, after O'Rourke had dropped out, now endorsing Mike Bloomberg.
There you go.
Thank you so much. That might be a sign of things to come. And in the endorsement, probably soon to be Senator Blanco. I think he's going to.
Well, no. But
he'll probably be the senator. But the point is, what he was saying was that Mike Bloomberg, had talked about Trump's rhetoric on immigrants leading to the August 3rd Walmart massacre in El Paso, on the gun issue specifically, they're fired up about that.
Right. Well, I just it's so funny because I've been thinking about this all morning, and I'm going, knowing what you've taught me about Texas, knowing what I know about Beto, knowing how Bloomberg began his first, you know, bus tour where in Austin, Texas, and he went to Texas. All those pieces say Bloomberg's highly paid consultants and lobbyists understand every single political storyline here, and they're going to tell Bloomberg, heavily court Beto, and Beto has some kind of a relationship potential with Bloomberg. It makes too much sense, and Texas is so important, and Texas is in play.
Right.
Oh, my God. All right. Now, talk to me about the special election. Well, you've been dancing around the special election for a long time. You've been preparing me that the Democrat will probably lose. So what ultimately happened?
Oh, Arnie, she lost by 20 points.
There we go. Thank you.
So I was trying to tell you.
I know.
Getting all fired up about this, and remember, we talked about the fact that NBC News, National, and Associated Press, and I think at least a couple of other national outlets had been writing this as the bellwether for what's going to happen in Texas in 2020, and had national national implications as well, and buying into this sort of bizarre argument that a seat that was held by about 10 points by a Republican in 2018 was somehow going to be the bellwether for 2020. I just never did see it. By the way, I'm putting together a column right now for QuorumReport.com. This is the title, Overhyped Battle in Fort Bend County, is the first part of Greg Abbott's plan to consolidate power by defending Texas House seats. This is what's really going on, Arnie.
Right.
This is a seat that is a solid Republican seat, full stop. I was trying to tell people this. I essentially had to just rip the polling data from the GOP in this deal. I published it last week at QuorumReport.com. I wanted to wake people's eyes up to the idea that this is not a flippable seat, and because it's not, people shouldn't assume that it means that other supposedly suburban counties around the state are going to perform the same way as this one.
Right.
That poll that I found said that the Republican was up by 13 points with a margin of error of 6. So the poll was right, right?
Yep.
I mean, you know, the Republican won by about 20 points.
19 points. 19, exactly.
Yeah, so you look at this thing and you go, oh, okay. Who all had endorsed the Democrat who was running for this Texas House seat? Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Mike Bloomberg had blocked for her, Castro had blocked for her. Beto was there at the watch party for the Democrat on Tuesday night when I was there in Fort Bend County. I thought about handing him a campaign sticker for the Republican candidate because he helped get him elected. I was sitting there thinking that this is not a seat that's flippable. And so I look around the state. In 2018, in suburban counties, in the Austin area, Houston area, Dallas-Fort Worth, Democrats were either making incursions in Republican territory or they were making the Republicans sweat by being within 2 or 3 points. Those are the districts where the Democrats have the opportunity to pick up the 9 seats that they need to be able to take the majority in the Texas House. Remember, a few months back, I had told you that on the same night, there was a speech in Dallas, there was a speech in Austin. One speech was President Trump at the American Airlines Center saying to his supporters, Texas is rock solid Republican. Don't worry about it. We've got it locked down. It's going to be beautiful. That's a pretty close quote. And on another stage, I was watching Karl Rove in Austin at the Texas House GOP caucus
warning
retreat.
Warning them.
Where he was saying,
right,
if current trends hold,
exactly,
the next Speaker of the Texas House
will be a Democrat.
That's right. And so, and look, those things can both be true at once. Think about the fact that President Trump is so polarizing. That also makes those who are opposed to him so polarizing, right? Impeachment going on, there's nowhere for anybody to hide. You're either for it or you're against it. One of the numbers in the poll in Fort Bend County that was probably the most revealing to me, even more than the top line about the candidates, the question was asked, everything that you've seen and heard, based on that, do you support removing the president from office? And the answer in that county, in that district, was 56% no.
Yeah.
Right, so these are rock-solid Republicans in that area.
Right.
But in other places, that's just not the case. In other places, Democrats can make their case. And I would say this, Arnie, I was on the ground there in Fort Bend County Tuesday as the runoff was happening. At 7 a.m., it was raining in Houston. It was just nasty out. And there were Democrats and Republicans coming out at first thing in the morning on a Tuesday in January to vote in the special election. You know, with their raincoats and their umbrellas. And I'm used to seeing, and this is about voter intensity,
right?
I'm used to seeing, sort of the Tea Party voters in the state were the ones who were willing to crawl over broken glass in the rain to be able to, vote against a rhino or a Democrat. But look, you had Democrats and Republicans who were fired up. And if that vote, this is what I would say about this, if that voter intensity holds or is even more intense in November, in those places where the numbers actually work for Democrats and put the seats within reach, then Katie, bar the door, because we're going to see a very different result in November.
So let me ask a question. One of the things that we talk about is expanding the base. What kind of expansion of the base do Republicans have in Texas? I mean, they've been such a comfortable shoe. They've controlled Texas politics forever. They basically have been in the driver's seat. So as they are scared about what the Democrats are going to do, as the Democrats are looking at the changing demographic and really see a whole cast of characters that they could actually bring into the voting booth, where the hell do Republicans go? Do they go to the couple of thousand Californians that move there? But, of course, they're going to vote anyway because they're bringing their sort of intelligentsia, their wealth, and the reason why they're moving to Texas with them. And as you pointed out, they're going to vote Republican. But they're not going to be able to eclipse what I think the new potential voter is. So where do Republicans go?
Republicans are looking for new voters in this state.
I know.
Rove, in his efforts, has said—
Are they going to cemeteries? I'm just curious.
Karl Rove has said in his efforts that they have identified at least about a million potential Republican voters in the state who they need to register. They do have some efforts going on to try to register new Republican voters. And you know how those efforts work, Arnie. They'll stand outside of a Walmart or wherever and ask you some questions with their clipboard. And the first question would be, are you for banning all abortion? If you say yes, they say, well, are you registered to vote? Let's get you signed up. And, Democrats
are you for banning all abortion?
Democrats have a version of that as well, of course. They ask a few questions and then try to figure out how they would register you. In Texas, important to remember, people are not registered by party. They're not registered by Republican or Democrat or Independent. So they have to do some other tricks to kind of try to figure out where you would be at on things. I'm told that through their various efforts, one of those efforts is funded to the tune of $10 million to try to register new voters for Republicans. So far, they've only found, and this is, months in the works now, at least 6 months, they've only registered about 14,000 people across the state. Texas voter registration is at a record of 16 million-plus people. We're adding new voters since 2012. At a record pace, voting registration was essentially flat in kind of the decade before that. But as we like to say at Quorum Report, President Trump has certainly converted more people from civilians into political combatants than anybody else.
No, absolutely. Now the other thing is that we were talking about Michael Bloomberg and the courtship of Beto and the fact that that candidate endorsed Michael Bloomberg. Michael Bloomberg has spare cash to spend everywhere.
Yes.
So you talked about the fact that the Republicans are trying to figure out a way to enroll a million voters. Michael Bloomberg must be aware of that as well. Has Michael Bloomberg cut any checks to help the Hispanic community enroll voters? Has he cut any check to, on the other side? Because he can, that's what's so amazing about him, which is so frightening, is not only can he spend up to maybe even $2 billion on his campaign, but he can throw a couple of $100 million here and $100 million there and pick his niche issues to support. And frankly, registering voters in Texas would be a great niche issue for him.
Yeah, not so far that I know of, but
maybe he'll listen to this conversation.
We'll keep an eye on it. It is interesting that Bloomberg has committed in Texas and other places to continuing to spend resources to try to beat Donald Trump, even if he's not the nominee. So, changing the dynamics. And look, Bloomberg, let's get real, Arnie. I mean, here's this billionaire guy who could spend, as a friend said the other day, he could spend $2 billion on the effort.
Oh, yeah.
And he would not miss it.
He
would make that back in 5 years.
Oh, well, he probably made it back in the tax cuts. I mean, I hate to break it to you because remember he owns Bloomberg News. He owns his own personal fortune.
So these are all real dollars that we know of, right? Because everything that he does is publicly traded. We can see what's going on there.
Right.
And through those tax cuts, the irony may be that Trump gave him that sort of lagniappe that he needed to be able to put this in.
He did. It's just shocking. Okay, last but not least, let's talk a little bit about John Cornyn, because obviously he is running for the United States Senate. You mentioned that he raised $2.8 million in the fourth quarter and that the Democrat vying to replace him only raised about $1 million. So tell me a little bit about the dynamics there.
Senator Cornyn is sitting on a healthy war chest right now. He did raise a pretty decent amount, like you said, $2.8 million. In the fourth quarter, I would say $1 million for a Democratic candidate is doing pretty well in Texas right out of the gate. they do have 8 or 9 Democrats who are running to try to take on Cornyn in the fall. There are like 4 or 5 of them that I can remember their names. You know, that we'll figure out who advances to a runoff if that's the case. The candidate who raised $1 million is MJ Hager, who you may remember,
was
a candidate for Congress in 2018. And she was one of those who was sort of on the front line seats, you know, as Democrats tried to flip the congressional seats. She ran against Congressman John Carter here in the Houston area, or excuse me, in the Austin area. And she came pretty close. She was in sort of like 3 points. She performed well in rural parts of the district, which is interesting. You know, in rural Texas, you can bank about a, historically about 1 million extra votes for Republicans in the state after the first counties, the big counties, report their vote totals. It's always interesting to see on election night, Arnie, the large counties, Harris County, and remember, Texas is so big. I think Rick Perry's commercials for governor used to say something like, Texas is big, what you think? The big counties will report first, then those rural areas come in later. And so we did see on election night in 2018, Democrats leading Republicans statewide. When the first big counties reported, of course, all of those other 200-plus counties eventually get their numbers into the Secretary of State, and you see the Republicans.
And on that note, Scott Braddock.
It's a completely different dynamic.
I know.
A different kind of Democrat running for Senate.
Trust me, that was what described my race in 1996. It was when the rural counties came in that I lost by 5 points.
There you
and
go.
It was all in places where, you know, there's one person every, 10 miles. And on that note, Scott Braddock is the editor of The Quorum Report. He's also affectionately known as The Voice of Texas. Next time we talk, it'll be after the Iowa caucus, and then the following, you'll be joining me in studio. How exciting for the New Hampshire primary.
Here we go.
All right, everyone, stick around. We've been talking a lot about Texas and elections. Now we're going to be talking about Brexit. I'll be right back.
Are you rain ready on this current cast? Many people in the Great Lakes region have experienced the misfortune of finding water in the basement during heavy rain. Now a free online tool called My Rain Ready can help homeowners assess and address their flood risk. Marcella Bondi Keenan of the Chicago-based Center for Neighborhood Technology says users answer questions about their home and landscaping. The tool estimates their flood risk and provides custom recommendations.
So things as simple as making sure their gutters are clear and making sure that the street sewer grates are cleared.
Or more advanced actions, such as replacing a concrete patio with a garden that will absorb stormwater and help make a home more rain-ready. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Bye.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott. So I think it's January 31st is really the last day that the United Kingdom will still be a part of the EU. And then it is over. And in order to celebrate that on January 31st, I saw an article at theconversation.com. I know you've heard me talk about how wonderful theconversation.com is, and I continue to sing its praises. And the title of the piece is, Britain is about to leave the EU. What's next? Joining us is the author of this piece, Luke Reeder. He is a teaching fellow at the History Department at Case Western Reserve University. But Luke, I love what you write about. I love what you teach about. I think if I came back as a second life, I would want to be doing what you do. So describe to my audience a little bit about your history and who you are, because I think it will help inform the article that you wrote.
Yeah, sure. So obviously I'm originally from the UK. I've lived in the United States for about 18 years. And I teach classes on the cultural and social impact of Brexit on the UK. So, you know, so rather than sort of look necessarily at the history, I sort of look at what it's doing now. It's a kind of contemporary history thing.
Yeah, which I think is so important, because in a lot of ways it will help us understand how we got to Brexit. It will also help us understand the level of disappointment, depending on how you got there, mm-hmm. after they leave Brexit. And I wrote something that I thought was just so interesting, because like everything else, it is a marriage of two very different players that basically right. voted for Brexit. And I think, I was a death penalty person. I'm just going to give you an analogy. I was a death penalty person, and I'm a liberal, lefty, progressive. So who did I end up pairing with? Libertarians. Because libertarians don't trust government, which is why they didn't want government to have the capacity to off you. Mm-hmm. I didn't believe in the death penalty, which is why I supported the repeal of the death penalty. Two completely different raison d'être, but we were wedded together for the purposes of defeating the death penalty. So that is sort of the bottom line here. So now talk to my audience a little bit about the history of the players that came in that wanted to see the UK leave the EU.
Right. So really, ever since Britain joined the EU, and this was back in 1973, people have been agitating to leave. There was a referendum in 1975 in which Britons voted by about two-thirds to one-third to remain in what was then the European Economic Community. And you know, throughout that period, and really up through the 21st century, there'd been sort of two sort of consistent groups of people who'd been agitating to leave the European Union. One was sort of these economic libertarians, people who felt that the EU was sort of putting too much red tape on business, was sort of trying to regulate the types of things that businesses could do, where businesses could sell, what businesses could sell. So that was one group who were agitating. The second group were people who were very concerned about sovereignty. And to sort of understand this, you need to realize that sovereignty is really, really the key question in English and later British history. It's sort of one of the sort of great continuities of the British and English past is who is sovereign, whether it be the monarch or parliament, or in the 18th, 19th, 20th centuries, sort of wars against European rulers who are seen from the British perspective as tyrannical, and in many cases were. So people sort of drawing on that tradition felt that the EU was a type of sort of universalizing European power on the, you know, on the level of something like Napoleon or the Kaiser or the Nazis, and was therefore something to be resisted as well.
But also, weren't they, I mean, from what I get, it was sort of the more struggling classes who basically saw that, you know, everything that had sort of been the stabilization of the UK was being drained away by the EU, and they wanted back their industries and they wanted back their control, and they didn't want other people coming in to take away their jobs. It feels very much like the argument that we hear with Donald Trump.
Yeah, exactly. And they become the third group who are sort of gradually convinced to vote for Brexit, right? So if you imagine the second, the first two groups are, they're relatively small, but they're quite culturally powerful. They're often wealthier, or they have access to the means of communication, newspapers, TV. And so if you imagine this sort of message being broadcast day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, it begins to resonate. And the European Union, which was never terribly popular to begin with anyway, gradually becomes less and less popular as more and more people come to see it doing these things that you describe, sort of leading to the decline of industry, you know, jobs going overseas from industrial parts of England to Poland, say, or Spain, or Portugal, and people are gradually beginning to blame the European Union for that. And then, particularly after 2008, you have a sort of massive rise in immigration to the UK, feeling that immigrants from, particularly from Eastern Europe, are taking away sort of British the jobs of British people, and then the refugee crisis in 2015, which is presented as the EU sort of trying to impose refugees on the UK, sort of helps convince people that Britain will be ultimately better off outside of the European Union. It's sort of conditioning people to think in a particular way over a very long period of time.
But isn't the other problem, too, that, you know, one of the things that Boris Johnson had to his advantage is that you have multiple parties. And if you were opposed to Brexit, you had a bunch of choices of who to vote for. If you basically supported Brexit, you had only one party to vote for, and that was Boris's party. So in a lot of ways, even as we describe three different raisons d'être for why people wanted to support Brexit, they only had one party choice. And if you wanted to stay in the EU, you had many parties to choose from. Therefore, Boris wins just because he's got the only flavor of the month that gets you to goal, which is Brexit.
Yeah, exactly. Now, you know, as I described in my article, I sort of explained that actually people who either wanted a slight majority of people voted for parties that either wanted to remain in the European Union or wanted to have a close relationship with the European Union. But the fact that these votes were scattered across four different parties and the nature of our sort of voting system, which is pretty similar to the American first past the post, plurality wins, meant that the Conservatives got what was quite a large majority in Parliament of 80 seats.
Well, you know, the only reason I'm smiling about this is I was reading it in your article. A little sidebar story. I'm good for sidebars. In 2015, Bernie Sanders called me up and said, "Arnie, can I borrow your house?" This is January of 2015. I'm an old politician. I've known Bernie for 30 years, and I live in Concord, New Hampshire. "Why do you want to borrow the house?" And he said, "I think I'm running for president." And I start laughing hysterically. I mean, this is like, oh, come on, Bernie. You know, you come from a state the size of a suburb. Who are you? You've never been a party player. You're an independent Democratic Socialist. So he comes to my house, and this is exactly what you are saying here with Boris Johnson. He comes to my house, and he talks, and then finally nobody asks the question that I ask. And I said to him, "Which party?" Now remember, he's always run as an independent, and he doesn't answer the question, Luke. And I said, "Well, let me be bloody honest with you, Bernie. If you don't pick a party, you should leave the house, because people are here for a conversation and not a solo performer. If Bernie Sanders had run as a Green, if Bernie Sanders had run as an independent, the message would have been identical to what he's running with now in the Democratic Party. He would have been nowhere. He needed to be in a significant party, just the way Boris was very lucky, because it was only the Conservatives that were offering the message of Brexit. It's exactly the same." It's incredible as I'm listening to you, because I see the parallels in so many ways. So let's talk about what's next, because that really is the operative language in your headline at theconversation.com. Mm-hmm. You don't have a freaking clue. Come on, Luke. I mean, what's next? Except that I think a lot of people are making certain assumptions about who they will be dealing with. And if they're angry at the EU, or perhaps the EU is maybe frustrated with the UK, where do they go to negotiate deals, finance, manufacturing, just sort of the economics that will run the country? I'm just trying to figure out where their choices are.
No, and I think that's a great question. And I think actually the way you described it as part of, you know, it creates part of the problem is that it's the uncertainty that's created by Brexit that's that's so damaging, is the fact that you've got things remaining broadly the same for the next year, but after this, things are so uncertain that in itself is a dampener.
Yep.
If you want to invest, if you're thinking about moving abroad, if you're thinking about sort of moving parts of your business operation around, you have no idea what's happening. And I think that uncertainty in and of itself is incredibly economically damaging.
You write in your piece, let me just quote from your piece, once it is no longer in the EU, no matter how close Britain is to the EU's single market, its influence will fade. In order to trade, Britain will have to accept EU rules, but will not have a role in setting those rules. If it diverges from EU regulations and standards, it closes off itself from European markets. I mean, talk about being screwed twice. If you want to play with them, you got to play by their rules, but you used to be able to participate in rulemaking, and now you have to be subservient and say basically, yes, whatever you say. Now the question is, if they resent that, where are they looking? Are they looking to places like India? I mean, I hear that, Donald Trump is saying, oh, Boris, you got us. We got to come play in the American market. I'm just trying to figure out how they figure out how to sort of change what has been, in a way, a comfortable shoe, having dealt with the EU for so many decades. And now this is a blank slate.
Yeah, and in many ways, I think this is a truth that people aren't really sort of facing up to properly yet. We do hear sort of a lot of sort of warm words about a trade deal with the United States, but the fact is, Britain and U.S. trade is almost at sort of capacity anyway. There's not a lot of room for flex there beyond sort of food products, things that are not currently allowed inside the U.K. I think there's a sort of vision that people are imagining. Volkswagens are going to be replaced by Chevrolets on sort of British streets, and that simply
they're
not
too
going
big.
To
they're too big. You like the Volkswagen; they fit on your streets. What are you talking about?
Well, they're too big, and Chevrolet and Cadillac have tried to sell cars in Europe for years and failed. But even beyond that, there's a sort of fundamental lack of recognition of what modern economies look like, which is sort of just in time. Product distribution, in the EU to manufacture a car. So, Honda Civics are manufactured in the UK, but parts of those cars cross borders multiple times before they get to the UK to be assembled. Or if you buy a product that's made in the UK, you're not just buying the product, you're buying the take the Honda again, you're buying the service, buying the service, you're buying the loan to purchase it with as well. So there's incredible, I think, sort of unwillingness to sort of look and see what is ultimately going to be a very sort of difficult decision for the UK to make, which is to either be a rule taker, not a rule maker, or to try and sort of take the more difficult path of finding new markets overseas.
I feel like it's become an even smaller player by doing this in so many ways. I mean, it may want to sort of look back at, its colonies. Let's call the Canadians. Let's call the Australians. Let's call New Zealand. Well, Australia's burning. Canada already has a player. Its major partner when it comes to trade is the United States. They just renegotiated NAFTA, so they've sort of reinforced their ability to continue to do that on the continent. And I'm just trying to figure out, what does Boris think? I mean, who does he turn to for guidance here, and how does he sell it, given, as you described, the three different groups that supported Brexit? One wants deregulation, and the other one wants more services and a more socialized nation.
Yeah.
Those are two completely different things. How do you deregulate, drain dollars from the British coffers, as the people who supported Brexit want more services? I don't see how Boris wins. I see only how Boris fails.
Yeah, I mean, he has a very difficult, unenviable task, albeit one of his own making. If he were pragmatic, he would probably sell out the people who brought him to power in the first place, because they're a much smaller part of his voting demographic. They're probably going to ultimately vote for him anyway. He needs to keep the people who brought him his election victory last year. He needs to keep those groups happy, and ultimately I think what they ultimately want is they want to see their communities and the lives of the people around them improve, and they're not particularly bothered how this happens, so long as this happens.
And so one of my producers just handed me something that I think makes me smile, because in a way it talks to the tension that we're seeing in the UK. She said, what about Trump's demand that healthcare be privatized in the UK? My understanding is that the NHS is very popular in Britain. And in fact, isn't that one of the first things that Boris Johnson did, was actually throw more money into the healthcare system in England? So again, these are the interesting tensions that you're going to see going forward. And not only is it going to make it difficult for Johnson to lead, but because they seem to be moving in opposite directions, how does he sell his economic plan to anyone? What is he offering India? What is he offering Canada? What is he offering even the EU? Because at this point in time, I think he's going to have to just take whatever they give him.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's probably likely in the long run. The thing Boris Johnson has proved very good at since being prime minister, to be fair, before, is selling something.
Donald Trump. Oh my God, selling something. Yep.
And so, you know, it won't be for a population that's even where people support the European Union, they don't like the European Union very much.
Right.
It won't be that difficult to say, well, this is the best thing that we could get from those sort of dastardly Europeans. You know, look at what those dreadful Europeans did to us, but look, I managed to claw this back or this back or this back. And, you know, that fits into a pattern,
right,
of behavior from British prime ministers for decades now. What could be relatively small victories in arguments with Europe, and sort of blowing them up into these sort of big sort of dynamic victories over a sort of continental hegemon, and then sort of ignoring the things Britain had done very well over decades, which has really shaped Europe in its own image in many respects.
Well, so two questions before I let you go, Luke Reeder. Luke Reeder is a teaching fellow at the History Department at Case Western Reserve. His piece at theconversation.com was, Britain is about to leave the EU. What's next? My understanding is it's January 31st, the day that we actually aired this show, that we're going to be sort of celebrating Brexit. So talk to me about Ireland and Scotland. Because, again, Scotland voted once to leave the UK. It became very close. In fact, the night of the Scottish referendum, I had two people from Scotland staying at my house, and I was scolding them. What are you doing here? Why aren't you in Scotland? And they said they voted absentee. They assured me of that. But I'm kind of curious, what does it mean for the definition of United Kingdom?
Again, that's another thing that's been made incredibly uncertain. There is a growing sense in Scotland that, you know, there is a desire, a growing sense that Scotland and the rest of the UK, or particularly England, are on two different paths. You know, how this is going to translate into independence itself is difficult to see, in the sense that the path to an independence referendum is blocked by the government in the UK, which sort of creates a problem for the SM, for the Scottish National Party, in that they could run a sort of unofficial referendum, like the sort of thing that's been seen in Catalonia, say.
Yeah, exactly.
But then you run into conflict with the British state itself. And the other problem is that Scotland gaining independence, actually, in many ways, it becomes harder after Britain leaves the European Union, because Scotland then needs to sort of figure out how to sort of extricate itself from its largest sort of trading market, with a place in the European Union not necessarily assured. And so the sort of problems you see with Britain negotiating with the European Union, mm-hmm. you'll see reflected in Scotland negotiating with the UK. But there is also a very real sense that, you know, the two parts of the UK are sort of diverging pretty rapidly, even to the extent that, you know, the Scottish Conservative Party are beginning to sort of distinguish themselves from the UK Conservative Party. The Scottish Labour Party is distinguishing itself from its UK equivalent.
Uh-huh.
You're beginning to see a sort of gradual separation. I sort of wonder, you know, if in the long term you'll sort of see a sort of gradual sort of withering of bonds, rather than a sort of instant you know, instant sort of cataclysmic thing that occurs after a referendum.
So, last question. Let's talk about Ireland, because that to me is, I think, the greatest challenge, because you already have two separate. You've got Northern Ireland, you have Ireland. So tell me what happens there.
I mean, what happens there right now is that, for all intents and purposes, under the withdrawal treaty, Northern Ireland will be sort of considered as sort of a quasi part of the sort of European Union sort of customs zone. And the reason for this is to try and sort of prevent there being a hard border on the border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland.
Okay.
Instead, customs checks, all those sorts of things, will be done sort of in an imaginary sort of place somewhere down the middle of the Irish Sea. The problem is how that is actually going to work is not entirely clear. Goods cross back and forth. People cross back and forth across the border multiple times a day. You know, people routinely go from one country to another country to buy petrol, to
get
to the supermarket. So the difficulty there is that you're sort of you're throwing aside a settlement you know, that has kept the peace for over 20 years, and you're sort of creating something that's designed to sort of replicate that process, but how it will operate is untested. And how it makes people think, we don't know. Is this going to motivate a closer connection for many in Northern Ireland to the Republic of Ireland? It may well do. And if that's the case,
that's good.
How do people who feel a strong connection to the UK, how do they react? These are things we don't know.
Right.
These are also sort of incredibly combustible issues in Northern Ireland.
That was the one thing I was trying to figure out, is how do they thread them together? And it sounds like what you're describing is that Northern Ireland becomes sort of this interesting island. It's like a mugwump. It's neither here nor there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fine initially, but that's not sustainable. And,
no, it's not.
And I think that's what is so frightening for me, is that it's not sustainable. And recognizing the tension between the two historically, the last thing you want to do is throw a match.
Right, and you can look across the globe at places that have are these sort of neutral zones, and you know they do tend to be sort of rather tense places. Even if there is a sort of peace kept, it's a peace that's kept in order to sort of dampen down local tensions. And there's also actually a UK-US trade deal component to Northern Ireland as well, which is that Nancy Pelosi's threatened, you know, rightly, I think, to veto any trade deal with the UK if there aren't sufficient provisions made to protect the Good Friday Agreement. So, even Northern Ireland, which you could argue is a sort of very localized issue, it does have a sort of massive impact on post-Brexit planning.
So let me read your last sentence. None of this is to suggest that Brexit cannot be a success. Oh, you're so hopeful. But Britain is in a geopolitical pickle. It is reasserting itself as a nation state at precisely the moment in which the world is reorganizing itself into powerful multinational alliances and trading blocks. Thank you so much for joining us, Luke Reeder. I appreciate this, and I'm going to have to check in with you in about a year. And therefore, we can sort of see whether they're still in that geopolitical pickle, which I'm sure they will be. But it will be interesting to see what moves they make as they finally have to deal with the fact that Brexit is now their reality, and how much leeway either they want from the EU or the EU will actually give to them. I mean, I think that's still a question. Am I correct?
Right, yes. I mean, yeah. I mean, this is, you know, in many respects, until now, everything's been sort of
a what if.
Yeah. What if now, you know, this will be a clarifying moment, and people will have to sort of really sort of think very hard about what they want from Brexit, which I think is probably the one benefit of this point in time.
Exactly. Luke Reeder, thank you so much. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. It's the Friday edition of The Attitude. We'll see you next week. You better think about what you're trying to do to me. Think, let your mind go, let yourself be free. Let's go.
contains.